All right. Hi, everyone. It is now 1 p.m., so we're going to go ahead and get started. Let's get into some quick housekeeping rules before we jump into the training today. Today's training is being recorded and will be offered on demand through Clue-In for those who are not able to join us during our live sessions. The Clue-In training page also has the slides available for download. While in Zoom, you have access to the Q&A window. Please use the Q&A box to ask questions, make comments, or report technical problems at any time during today's training. We have several team members serving as subject matter experts in the background, and they will be responding to your questions. Please note that time likely will limit us, and we expect not to answer all the questions that are submitted today. Additionally, our trainers are not able to respond to questions that ask about states or EPA actions, as well as legal or regulatory interpretation questions. For those interested in receiving certificates of completion, they are available at the end of the training by completing the feedback form. The feedback form for all ITRC courses are located in the Clue-In training page for each specific course. Today's training is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, or ITRC, and is hosted by the U.S. EPA Cleanup Information Network, also known as Clue-In. The Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council is a program of the Environmental Council of the States. ITRC is a state-led organization composed of over 1,000 members from state agencies, federal government, the private sector, academia, and community stakeholders. ITRC members participate in technical teams which produce tools, resources, and training courses, such as the one you are participating in today. Please visit the ITRC website if you're interested in becoming an active member or need to view the full ITRC disclaimer. If you plan to use ITRC materials, we ask that you review those terms and conditions in detail and be sure to credit ITRC. ITRC is partially funded by the U.S. government. ITRC nor the U.S. government warranty the material nor endorse any specific products. On behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, welcome to today's training, PFAS Beyond the Basics, Fate and Transport Site Characterization and Source ID Training, which is based upon ITRC PFAS team online resources. My name is Taylor Vogel, and I will be your moderator today. This training class builds on the earlier information for introductory PFAS topics presented in the PFAS 101 Clue-In training. The Beyond the Basics class provides more in-depth information for fate and transport, site characterization, source ID, and some introductory information on environmental forensics. These topics will be presented along with options and a framework for data visualization. This training will focus largely on PFAS, fate, and transport in groundwater. Before we dive in, just a quick note, some of the links presented in today's training may be broken or out of date. If you run into any issues accessing the link, don't worry, you can always navigate directly to the main guidance document and use the table of contents to find the specific sessions we are referencing. I will now be turning it over to Robert with the Alaska Department of Conservation to get us oriented on today's training.
Okay, thank you, Taylor. So as Taylor noted, this is the Beyond the Basics training for PFAS, fate and transport, site characterization, source identification, and forensics. My name is Robert Burgess. I'm from the Department of Alaska, the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. We also have with us Ted Campbell from the North Carolina DEQ, Skylar Sorsby with WSP, Dina Drennan, BM Systems, and Chris Olivares with the University of California, Irvine. So those are your trainers today, and we'll just jump right into it here. This is, again, part of our Beyond the Basics trainings. So we have five of these Beyond the Basics trainings. This one, of course, is the, As mentioned, source ID, site characterization, fate and transport. We also have treatment technologies, biosolids, soil leaching, and mobility, which has some overlapping content with this one, just a little bit. Human health effects, ecological toxicity, and regulations, and then a sampling and an analysis Beyond the Basics course as well. So check those out. There's good content in all of that. So for today's training, our objectives are really to help folks understand the fate and transport processes that are unique to PFAS due to the physical and chemical properties of PFAS, And then we'll talk a little bit about how to characterize these sites with those processes and properties in mind, keeping in mind, how that Phaeton transport informs our approach to site characterization. And then we'll look briefly at the application of forensic techniques for source identification and differentiation. The goal is really to provide detailed information about the inputs practitioners can use to develop a robust conceptual site model to help understand fate and transport of PFAS at a particular site and how to gather evidence when we have potential multiple sources. We will really focus on this presentation largely on PFAS transport in groundwater or the saturated zone. We will touch briefly on transport in other media, but for additional in-depth information, you can take a look at the online guidance document in Section 5 for Phaeton transport, Section 10 for site characterization, and you can also get some information from the other PFAS Beyond the Basics series. So we are going to start by talking about Phaeton transport considerations, and at this point, I'll turn it over to Dina Drennan.
Great. Thank you, Robert. So as Robert alluded to, I'll be talking about Phaeton transport in terms of PFAS-specific phenomena. And so our discussion on Phaeton transport will focus on how these small-scale processes at the pore scale can govern transport in soils and groundwater. And ultimately, the sum of all these tiny small effects can result in large-scale transport between environmental media. We'll cover it in terms of compound-specific chemistry, as well as environment chemistry and how those two influence PFAS transport in the environment. Okay. That was kind of what I was going to talk about with that green box. So next. Phaeton transport is the environmental behavior of contaminants as informed by both the characteristics of your contaminant and the characteristics of the site. And with PFAS in particular, where we have very unique chemistry, we should pay special attention to those PFAS characteristics. And on the left side of the slide here, we see some of the properties of PFAS that influence their behavior in the environment, and we'll be going over some of these in more detail. But that's really not the complete story without a solid understanding of how site characteristics on the right can interact with the chemistry to influence this behavior. So combining these data sets will ensure that appropriate understanding of Phaeton transport for PFAS is addressed at your conceptual site model. Okay, so here we're going to review some of the properties of perfluoroalkyl acids. And perfluoroalkyl acids are a subset of PFAS compounds that we think about that typically have screening limits, even though that list is rapidly expanding. So these are your PFOS, PFOA. And PFAAs, perfluoroalkyl acids, are canonically understood to be surfactants. And by surfactants, they have a hydrophilic head and a hydrophobic tail. And these competing properties are going to drive a lot of their behavior in the environment. Particularly, what we'll focus on here today is that interfacial interaction. So, surfactants like interfaces, and this ionic polar head and hydrophobic tail really drive that interfacial activity. So, zooming in even further, how PFAAs assemble at interfaces is really important to understanding their partitioning in the vadozone, which is driven by interfaces, air-water interfaces, water-soil interfaces, soil-air interfaces. You have all these interfaces to consider. And probably the most important one in the vadozone is that air-water interface. This is also a relevant interface to think about with respect to surface water. And so Like we said, these are surfactants, and many surfactants are hydrocarbon surfactants, which have a CH bond. And because this is a CF bond and has lower polarizability than that CH bond, we see that affinity for interfaces amplified for PFAS compounds. So it's even more important for PFAS than it is for what other surfactants may be doing in the environment. And so, while we're focusing on these PFAAs and how they align at these interfaces, the other side of the coin is what's going on in the bulk solution. So what is the water chemistry and how does that influence either accumulation at the interface or potential to be in the aqueous phase? Okay. So moving on from the PFAA specific chemistry, and looking at environmental factors or site specific factors that will influence sorption on a micro scale, these can largely be lumped into two categories, the electrostatic and hydrophobic interactions. And these govern a lot of site specific PFAS behavior. So when you're building your CSM or doing your site investigation, these are a good thing to have a handle on to understand how PFAS is going to interact with your environment. So on the left-hand side here, we have a summary of some of the electrostatic interactions that influence partitioning. Specifically, the charged clay surfaces or cations in a soil or groundwater environment, to that matter, can sorb to negatively charged head groups. So for PFAs, and this is also relevant for fluorotelomer sulfonates and fluorotelomer acids, which are polyfluorinated as opposed to perfluorinated. And then in contrast to increased sorption due to charge, you can have changes in soil pH. For example, if you've done ISCO at your site, you're going to increase your soil pH, and that can potentially decrease your sorption capacity in your soil. So again, knowing the history of your site and your soil chemistry can go a long way in defining how PFAS sorption manifests at a site. And then on the other side of the slide here, we have a summary of some of the hydrophobic interactions that can drive PFAS sorption. And so the big one we think about is sorption to organic matter. Particularly, this is relevant for long chain PFAS, so like your PFOS compounds as opposed to like a PFBS. And this is why we general, and so there's stronger sorption with those longer chain compounds. And in general, this is why we see short chain compounds will travel further than long chain, longer chained PFAS in groundwater, because those longer chain PFAS get stuck on that organic matter. And so you get somewhat of a chromatographic effect where short chain compounds are just transported further as a function of not being as sticky to organic matter as their longer chain counterparts. With respect to head group chemistry, we also have sulfonates, so your PFSAs, this is your PFOS, and they sorb more strongly to organic matter as compared to their carboxylate counterparts, so your PFOAs. And so of equal, if you're looking at two compounds of equal chain length, you can look to their head group chemistry to inform how far they can they would likely transport relative to each other. And while not typically analyzed for, the branching or lack thereof of this carbon fluorine chain can also influence sorption to organic matter. So if you have these linear chains, you would get stronger hydrophobic interaction with organic matter, but same compound with a branch chain is going to be less sorptive. And again, that's not something typically analyzed for, but it can explain if you're seeing something that doesn't make sense here. And so, if we're thinking about the chemistry of our PFAS, the chemistry of our water, the chemistry of our soil, it begs the question, which partitioning is most important where? And there we go. And the good news is it's not everything all the time, everywhere, all at once. The relative importance of a compartment's interfacial behavior varies between our source area, which we largely understood to be unsaturated vadose zone, and versus the plume or the saturated zone. So, as we talked about in the vadose zone, PFAS absorption is largely interfacially driven. So, in particular, the PFAS want to be on that air water interface, and this is going to drive much of that mass distribution. On the other hand, in the saturated zone, where you don't have an air water interface, it's effectively zero. The sorption to the soil is driving a lot of that behavior. So those electrostatic and hydrophobic effects are driving transport more than interfacial adsorption. So you think about different sorptive capacities in different compartments. It's not all the same. And so this is, the degree to which these retentive properties can attenuate mass flux is an area of active research. And I will direct you to section 5.2 of the TechRag document, which goes into greater detail, but it is rapidly evolving. Okay. And so zooming in on some of these interfaces and how they vary dynamically. So if we're thinking about our vadose zone and how saturation is not always the same in the vadose zone, it's, your air water interfacial area is going to vary with, on a day that it rains versus, a drought scenario. So you're going to have different degrees of saturation, and those different degrees of saturation, as you can see on the left-hand side here, result in different air water interfacial area, which will in hand result in different sorption capacity. And so you can think about this in terms of the periodicity, persistence, and intensity of recharge events. But also in this slide, and it's kind of to the right here and not as explicit, is there are other factors that affect air water interfacial area, including soil type, grain size, and heterogeneity. So, again, going back to your conceptual site model, understanding your soil type will get you pretty far with understanding how that soil drains, what sort of saturation you can expect, and knowing your climate can also give you information about recharge. So all of these are built in to our conceptual site model. And so this kind of summarizes the different components of solid phase absorption that we discussed here. And it is an interplay between the chemistry of your contaminant and the chemistry of your soil or water, right? Much of these can be considered dynamic and therefore requires robust site characterization. So hydrophobic sorption sites can get filled up quickly by those long chain PFAS and result in a chromatographic release of shorter chain PFAS downstream. We've found that our sulfonates sorb more strongly than our carboxylates. And all of this is organic carbon dependent. So you can have organic carbon-rich soil at the top of your soil column, and that can decrease with depth. And so you have a spatial component. Or if you've done some organic carbon amendments in your soil, such as biosolid application, that can also influence hydrophobic partitioning. So the history of your site. Moving on to electrostatic interactions, considering changes in pH and ionic strength, either naturally induced or because of some remedial action that has taken that has occurred at the site, can be considered dynamic. And then there is one thing that PFAS does that other contaminants do is sorption sites become saturated. So it's a concentration dependent, nonlinear sorption behavior. So we have that one thing. And then what we're just barely touching on here, and will be discussed in more detail later, is precursor transformation can increase the observed PFAAs from your time zero. So you measure your PFAAs, and then you get a bunch of precursor transformation either biotically or oxidatively. And now you're measuring more PFAAs. Well, those are going to be kicking off your shorter chain compounds and have implications for environmental fractionation as well. So the transformation effects, anything you do to your soil, anything you do to your groundwater, these can all influence partitioning. Then finally, bringing it back to where we began, this is a very simplified matrix that kind of shows how the characteristics of our contaminant and the characteristics of our site can result in either enhanced sorption or reduced sorption. And yeah, with that, I'll hand it off. Thank you.
Thank you, Dina. And so let me go to the next slide. So like Dina mentioned, PFAS can behave as surfactants. As any surfactant, one of the behaviors is they can form aggregates. So that means that they stop being entirely dissolved in the bulk phase, and they start assembling or performing cell assemblies with each other. So at certain higher concentrations, some PFAS can group together, forming the structures that you see on your right. So micelles, that would be a sphere-like structure where you have the perfluorinated tails facing inwards. But you can have also hemimycel, which is half of a micelle, as well as bilayers. So thinking about sticking into almost membrane-like behaviors. However, unlike other non-fluorinated surfactants, PFAS that can form these aggregates may have different processes than traditional surfactants. And that is because sometimes in some of the studies, aggregations have been reported on below what is called the critical micelle concentration, or the concentration at which you would expect to see the formation of these self-aggregates. And also, there are interactions with charged surfaces, like Dina was mentioning, that lead to sorption, as well as charged surfaces. So it might be a little more complex, and there is more research that is needed to understand how self-assembly behavior of PFAS, what it means for their transport and their fate in general. Now, looking at the family of the subfamily of non-polymeric PFAS, we see the majority of them are polyfluorinated compounds, which means that not every single carbon is fully saturated with a fluorine atom. So many of these precursors can be transformed into what are called terminal perfluorinated alkyl acids. Perhaps these are the most common types of PFAS that we've heard. So, for example, an example of PFCA is PFOA, or perfluorinated octanoic acid, as well as PFSAs like PFOS, perfluorinated octane sulfonate. So, some of these precursors can be transformed, and their chemistry, their structure indicate where they are transforming into either a carboxylic acid and a sulfonate. And as we are learning more about their transformation pathways, we can use this information for site assessment, characterization, and see how different PFAS plume might change with sources, with the age and history, perhaps a remediation of a potential site. Here we have an example of a polyfluorinated compound. So on the structure on the top, we see a fluorotelomere. This means that there is a certain number of carbons that are fully fluorinated. In this case, there's eight carbons that have completely saturated with fluorine. But then next door to those carbons, there's two other carbons that do not have fluorine in them, actually have indicated in the green spheres hydrogen. So they don't have fluorine. And so we call this an 8-2 fluorotelomer, and the terminal group is an alcohol. So you see an oxygen and a hydrogen. This compound, as you can see, has some carbons that are not fully fluorinated. And these carbons that are not fluorinated are open to transformation either through chemical or biological reactions. So usually most of the transformations that we see in the environment are oxidations. So in then this polyfluorinated compound can be oxidized into the structure below, the equivalent perfluorinated alkyl acid. In this case, it's a carboxylic acid. So we have here an example of formation of PFNA. And once this compound is formed, it's neither transformable or biodegradable on its own, which is why we call it a terminal product or a terminal perfluorinated alkyl acid. One thing to note, we go from eight fluorinated carbons, but in the name of the structure below is actually nine because the last carbon is the carbon that has the carboxylic acid group. So that's why it forms PFNA. Some of the transformations can occur abiotically. So these are entirely chemical transformations, and most of these reactions are oxidations, not all of them. But one of them is we can have fluoropolymers that over time can release side group chains that maybe some of those side group chains are monomeric PFAS, like in this example that we see in the cartoon in the top right. There is a side group that is the perfluorinated octanoic acid. We see these reactions, the release of monomeric PFAS especially under high pHs, but over decades, we can also see it at neutral pHs. Other common chemical reactions that we see in the environment is that hydroxyl radicals that are either formed in natural systems or in the built environment can themselves oxidize polyfluorinated compounds, precursors into the perfluorinated alkyl acid. So in the bottom right, you see a structure here of another fluorotelomer. This one is 6-2 fluorotelomer sulfonate. You see that after that fully fluorinated chain of carbons indicated by those brackets, then it has two carbons next door that do not have fluorine in them. And those carbons are open again for potential oxidation and it forms a perfluorinated carboxylic acid. The structure on the right and the bottom right that you see is a sulfonamide, and that sulfonamide also can be oxidized abiotically with hydroxyl radicals and also would cleave that carbon sulfur bond, forming perfluorinated carboxylic acids. Now, it doesn't mean that whenever we have a reaction of a precursor or polyfluorinated compound, that we were always going to end 100% yield into the carboxylic acid or perhaps the sulfonate. Sometimes we don't have a complete oxidation reaction, and this is actually quite common in the environment. There's an active field of research trying to understand the yield and the kinetics. And then lastly, we see also these reactions in the atmosphere. So we have indirect photolysis where we have this fluorotelomer alcohol that we were looking at in the previous slide being oxidized by atmospheric reactions into carboxylic acids. Now, switching into biological reactions, most of the transformation reactions that lead into the terminal products, the perfluorinated alkyl acids, are oxidations that occur under aerobic conditions, so in the presence of oxygen. Here we see two types of structures. In the top part, we see fluorotelomers. This one in particular that has a very long name, 6,2-FT-TAOS, is a component in some firefighting foams. As you can see, we get again the fully fluorinated carbon chain indicated by those brackets, six carbons, and then followed by other carbons that do not have fluorine in them. Well, it turns out that as we have these transformations occur, we form an intermediate, which is in this case the 6-2 fluorotelomer sulfonate, and eventually that intermediate can be transformed into our terminal products, the perfluorinated carboxylic acids. And under biological conditions, we often don't form one equivalent perfluorinated carboxylic acids from the fluorotelomere. We actually form a normal distribution, usually anywhere from N to N minus 2, so the N being the number of carbons of the carboxylic acids. So here we see an example where we have a 6 carbon perfluorinated carbon precursor, the 6-2 FTTAOS, leading into the C4, C5, C6, and C8 perfluorinated carboxylic acid. In the bottom figure, we see an example of another type of structure. This structure is called a sulfonamide, and it's also a kind of precursor. Now, in difference to the fluorotelomers, here we see that we get the fully fluorinated chain, and then next door, we don't get another carbon. We actually get a sulfur. So actually, for biological reactions, that typically leads to mainly the formation of perfluorinated sulfonates. So we see that the terminal product of these biological reactions tends to be perfluorinated hexane sulfonate. This is the 6-carbon equivalent of PFOS. Under anaerobic conditions, there's fewer studies that have looked at these conditions, and the reason is that usually we don't see in experimental timescales enough evidence of transformation all the time. There is some transformation, and whenever there's that transformation, it doesn't always lead into the perfluorinated carboxylic acids or the perfluorinated alkyl acids. So here we have again in the left an example structure of a precursor found in firefighting foam that only under nitrate-reducing conditions can lead eventually into the formation of carboxylic acids, just like the aerobic conditions in presence of oxygen. However, when we go into more reducing conditions, think about sulfate reduction, for example, we don't necessarily form the carboxylic acids, and sometimes we form other kind of precursors as well, and the reactions are incomplete. One example where we see this is in landfills, where oftentimes one intermediate that is commonly detected is the 5,3 fluorotelomer carboxylic acid, or 5,3-FTCA. And this is one example of places where we might have anaerobic conditions that do not always lead into perfluorinated carboxylic acids. Recently, there have been reported an anaerobic reaction under a process called Fiamox, is the anaerobic reduction of iron coupled to ammonium oxidation by the Acidemicrobium species strain A6, which has reported defluorination of PFOA and PFOS with release of fluoride. This is an active area of research. Now, with that, I will turn it over to Robert for the next slide.
Thank you, Chris. Great information there. So now that Dina and Chris have reviewed what's happening on a small scale in the subsurface to affect PFAS fate and transport, we'll take some time now to discuss the larger scale processes and how those relate to those micro scale processes that are happening. So we'll use this figure here. This model CSM essentially to walk through various media, touching briefly on air, soil, groundwater, and surface water, and then sediment. The black text on the figure shows the types of processes that we need to think about for each media type. So when we're talking about large-scale transport in air, the sources that we are concerned about might be things like stack emissions at industrial sites. But we can also have transport in air if there are volatile PFAS present, or if PFAS are aerosolized, for example, during fire training or response. So vapor phase or aerosolized PFAS can undergo transformation while in the atmosphere due to processes such as photooxidation. And non-volatile PFAS in air are usually being transported on particulates. They're attached to particulates that are being transported. So short range transport is is common at industrial sites. Wet or dry deposition can occur a short range from those industrial sites with stack emissions, and they can result in large diffuse areas of contaminated soil, which in some cases can leach to groundwater. And there have also been studies that have suggested longer range transport due to stack emissions. That's still an active area of research. More information on atmospheric transport of PFAS can be found in section 5.2.4 and section 5.4 of the online guidance document. So when we're looking at the vadose zone, there may be well, there's a lot to consider here, right? So Dina talked about partitioning to solid phases being dependent on electrostatic interactions with minerals and cations, as well as interaction with organic material through hydrophobic interactions. And we touched briefly on interfacial behavior. Now Chris talked about precursor transformation. So let's think about the factors that affect these processes on a larger scale here. Our vadose zone tends to be aerobic, which is ideal for precursor transformation, as you heard Chris talk about, as strongly sorbed cations and Zwitter ions transform. So cationic PFAS, many precursors are cationic or Zwitter ionic, and as they transform, the PFAAs, which are anionic, are formed. Then that might lead to desorption from soils because of different interactions, and then leaching to groundwater. So it can result in long-term sources if there's retention in the vadose zone, long-term sources to groundwater. So site-specific retention in the vadose zone is dependent on all those factors we talked about, as well as things like precipitation and infiltration rates and other processes that might occur at specific sites. Dina talked about how partitioning to air-water interfaces can have important implications. And again, that precipitation and infiltration rates are going to matter for that as well. So those infiltration rates, the soil porosity and particle size, and biogeochemistry, all of those are going to play a role in the extent to which these microscale processes are affected. One important thing to note as well when we're talking about vadose zone is that this is where we tend to find plant roots and animal burrows, right? So that means that contamination that gets retained in the vadose zone could be subject to uptake by biota. We're not covering that pathway in this presentation, but it is covered in the biosolids, soil leaching, and mobility beyond the basics training, which also goes into further detail about vadose zone transport in general. So check that out. There's archived recordings available. Now, if PFAS does leach to groundwater, once we're there, transport in the groundwater is expected to be faster relative to transport through the vadose zone. But again, this is going to be dependent on the characteristics of the PFAS in the groundwater, including things like the chain length and the head group when we're talking about PFAAs. And remember, anything affecting geochemistry can impact their transport. So to understand the partitioning behavior of PFAS in groundwater, we need the same types of information that we just talked about for understanding sorption and leaching from the vadose zone, plus information on groundwater chemistry, things like pH, cation concentration, redox conditions, and so forth. We want to consider if there's co-contaminants present, and other parameters that might affect sorption. If co-contaminants are present, oftentimes remediation may have occurred targeting those contaminants, especially if it's a site that's been around for a while and before we were really paying a lot of attention to PFAS. And if that remediation has occurred, as Dina mentioned, that can cause changes in our solution chemistry. So for example, if remediation has driven oxidation, it might increase the rates of precursor transformation, increasing the ratios of PFAAs as a result. Might also facilitate transport or retard transport by changing pH or other geochemical parameters, depending on the specific type of remediation or that has occurred. Other factors that are important to consider and understand with groundwater include, of course, groundwater flow direction and velocity, and factors that affect it, such as groundwater extraction or dewatering. We want to think about preferential flow pathways and hydrological connections with nearby surface water bodies. Now, if we are looking at PFAS transport in surface water, there's the type of water body is of course an important in considering how PFAS might move. So not only the type of the water body, but how it's recharged or sustained, and whether whether it is recharged by groundwater or whether it lends some of its some of itself to the groundwater. So slow moving water and fast moving water, for example, are going to have different concerns, right? The extent to which sediments or particulate matter are transported will be different. We have precipitation events when we're looking at surface water. They may dilute PFAS, an important consideration for timing of sampling, or it might cause additional transport to PFAS of PFAS to water bodies through runoff or storm drains, perhaps a particulate transport as well. Fish and other biota, of course, can uptake PFAS. It does bioaccumulate by binding to proteins, and there's potential for biomagnification of the food chain as a result. Really important consideration for surface water is that tendency of PFAS to aggregate at the air-water interface. The concentrations can be very high at the surface, and there's often stratification throughout the water column as a result. One interesting thing that can happen is with wind or turbulence, PFAS in this high concentration surface microlayer can form foams. It's kind of similar to how AFFF works. You mix water, PFAS, and air or agitation, and you can create foam. But it's important to note, though, this is distinct from AFFF foam. This is a different phenomenon. This is not AFFF, just a similar process for creating that foam. And then foams can float downstream or end up on shores, which can spread PFAS and create new areas of contamination in different surface water bodies or in soils or sediments. So when we're talking about foam, again, we can see these foam islands get transported to a new location and can travel downstream or be blown across a lake or other water body, depending on, of course, the flow rate and the wind action. Once it is transported that way, it can collapse back into the water column, or if it's on shore, it can collapse and create an area of soil contamination. And it's really critical to understand that the amount of PFAS that we find in foams tends to be enriched compared to the underlying water column, often by multiple orders of magnitude. There are also exposure concerns to consider with foams. Can imagine dogs, pets, kids, adults playing in the foams when they find them. So there's a lot that we still need to study about that exposure route, but it is something to consider if you're thinking about a conceptual site model out of sight. So one thing that's important to consider is transport between surface water and groundwater. It can go either way, either from groundwater to surface water or surface water to groundwater. This is kind of an active area of research. We do have some information from peer-reviewed articles and case studies that can help us to understand how PFAS behave in this transition zone, the hyperrheic zone. Just that transition between groundwater and surface water. So, for example, groundwater is often, not always, but often it's anoxic or reducing, and surface water in general tends to have a higher concentration of dissolved oxygen. Or there might be changes in the dissolved organics, the types and concentrations of ions in your groundwater or surface water systems, and other changes that can happen over that between surface water and groundwater. So that increasing oxygen that may occur, as well as the potential for increased biological activity, can lead to faster rates of precursor transformation. And some studies have documented increased proportions of PFAAs in surface water bodies compared to upgradient groundwater, which might indicate that that precursor transformation is occurring. So the differences in the organic or mineral content of saturated soils versus sediments of a water body can also have important implications. If we see higher cations or increased salinity, that can lead to increased sorption, as can increased organic content. And PFAS sorb to sediments, depending again on what type of water body you have, how fast it moves, and so forth. Those sediments can then be transported downstream, or there can be uptake, of PFAS by the biota that live in those sediments. So we also want to consider co-contaminants when we're thinking about PFAS. This is pretty common to see co-contamination, particularly at AFFF sites, but of course it can occur at other PFAS sites as well. PFAS might partition into LNAPL, or they can accumulate at interfaces, including the water-NAPL interface. That might lead to greater retention of PFAS if you have petroleum present. Petroleum contamination also will lead to reducing conditions, right? So anaerobic reducing conditions, which can slow down precursor transformation and change the pathways from aerobic pathways to the more anaerobic processes and pathways, which might, as Chris mentioned earlier, result in different products being formed during that transformation. I think we've hit on this a few times and we'll hit on it a few more, but if petroleum remediation has occurred, it can alter those redox conditions to a more oxidizing conditions. For example, if air sparge has occurred, or it might change the ionic concentrations, and that can change the rates of both precursor transformation in the case of, oxidizing conditions, or retention of PFAS when we change the ionic concentrations. It is important, it's maybe a little less studied, but DNAPL co-contamination can also result in increased PFAS retention. So using this hypothetical made-up example of an AFFF site, we can use this kind of cartoon, this diagram, to talk about how co-contamination affects PFAS migration in groundwater, and really just in more generally how differential transport can occur when you have a mix of different PFAS. So on the left side of this cartoon, we have our fire training area. That's our source area. We have LNAPL present. It's anaerobic and reducing conditions. We have highly concentrated PFAS and petroleum constituents. There may be some retention of some of the PFAS in the vadose zone, as well as at the air-water interface. And depending on what's going on in the subsurface, you might have retention in the saturated zone as well. Groundwater is flowing in this example from left to right, and the oxidation reduction potential is changing along the axis of the petroleum plume. So more reducing conditions near the source, and the more oxidizing conditions the further away you get from the source. And that, of course, as mentioned earlier, is due to biodegradation of petroleum and the consumption of oxygen and other favorable electron receptors that occurs during that biodegradation. Now, near the source area, we may or may not have LMAPL, which, if it is present, it may slow down PFAS migration, particularly at the water-NAPL interface. We also would tend, like I said, we have reducing conditions there generated by consumption of oxygen, slowing precursor transformation, potentially increasing retention due to associated changes in groundwater chemistry. But as we move from the source, we start to see lower concentrations of hydrocarbons, conditions that are less reducing, just as is common with petroleum plumes. And then precursor transformation rates might increase as we shift to aerobic pathways. That's if the precursors got that far in the first place, right? Beyond the petroleum plume, oxygen will tend to be higher. Precursors that have traveled this far will break down more readily. And then, due to the differential transport of short versus long chains, we'll also start to see a higher proportion of shorter chain PFAAs relative to the source area. And branched PFAAs will also be enriched compared to the source relative to linear isomers. So, again, this is dependent on the properties of the molecules, right? So, shorter chain PFAAs tend to migrate faster. They sorb less to soils. So it's you're going to see an increased proportion of those relative to total PFAS. I'm talking proportions here, not concentrations. Important to note that difference. And again, branched isomers, as Dina mentioned, also tend to travel faster and farther than their linear counterparts. So in addition to increased short chain PFAAs, we might see increased proportions of branched isomers if they are present and measured. All of this, we refer to it, this process as environmental fractionation, as the fraction of specific PFAS species that we see down gradient is often different from the fraction at the source. In other words, we should not expect the composition of PFAS in the source area to be the same as the composition or relative proportions down gradient. You get a rarefied set of those original constituents. And that's important to note when we talk about things like site characterization and the use and application of forensics, which we'll get to a little bit later in the presentation. At this point, we're going to switch a little bit to site characterization, and I'm going to turn this over to Ted Campbell.
All right. Thank you, Robert. That was an excellent presentation and really tees up, the material that I'm going to cover, which is key components of PFAS site characterization. Dina, Chris, and Robert have covered a number of details on PFAS chemistry, fate, and transport. They explained how the physical properties of PFAS and site characteristics affect retention and mobility. This information is a perfect foundation for our discussion of site characterization of PFAS. So, as you'll see, these themes inform how we think about specific information needed for site characterization. So, in this section of the training, we'll look at common source types and their associated transport pathways. We'll talk about how the hydrogeologic setting informs our understanding of PFAS sites and what kind of information should be gathered to understand PFAS transport. We'll also look at a few special considerations related to the sampling and analysis of PFAS. Note that in the interest of time, we won't go into a lot of details on sampling analysis, but we will drop a link in the chat box to an excellent archived ITRC training on this very topic. And we'll look at methods for interpreting and visualizing data to help us understand our conceptual site model. Now, before we get started, let's recall the purpose of a site characterization, which is to define the nature, sources, and extent of contamination, understand transport pathways, and identify potential receptors. This information is needed for risk assessment and remediation planning. With that in mind, let's now look at site characterization of PFAS. Okay, so site characterization usually begins with the development of an initial conceptual site model, or CSM for short. The CSM pulls together our conceptual understanding of site conditions, including PFAS releases, hydrogeologic setting, transport characteristics, exposure pathways. And it's here that we want to focus on site-specific characteristics and properties of PFAS or mixtures at the site, which taken together will affect fate and transport, as we're hearing. One important use of the CSM is that it helps us define our data needs, including numbers, types, and data quality objectives. It's often appropriate to develop an initial CSM prior to, or perhaps as part of, preparing the site investigation work plan. And we'll discuss this more in later slides. So, just to quickly review, the ITRC PFAS document identifies four primary types of PFAS sources to the environment, and they're listed here. We'll briefly run through some generalized CSMs for these source types and discuss some of the important differences or unique characteristics of each. Now, ITRC has identified these as the most common four types of PFAS sites, but it's important to note that there are potentially other sources of PFAS besides these. Additionally, biosolids from wastewater treatment plants may be land applied in agricultural settings. So this would represent a unique PFAS source type. Now, we won't touch much on biosolids in my session, but a recent ITRC training focused specifically on this topic, and we will drop a link to it in the chat box. So here's the first of three generalized CSMs for PFAS. This one shows a fire training and response site. These are sites that are associated with AFFF, aqueous film-forming foam, that contains high concentrations of PFAS for fire suppression. These sites also contain a hydrocarbon fuel source, which commingles with PFAS released at the site. Importantly, fire training sites often are used over and over, which multiplies the AFFF and PFAS that may be released at these sites. Now, because of the high solubility, mobility, and persistence of some PFAS, careful attention must be paid to any pathway that may transport PFAS from the release area. This might include surface water runoff, infiltration of groundwater, and groundwater transport to supply wells or surface waters. Multiple investigations have reported long-range transport of PFAS in surface water from AFFF releases. In some cases, even secondary groundwater plumes have been created miles away from the original source. This occurred, for example, at a site in Minnesota where surface water infiltrated to groundwater at a distant downstream location. And it resulted in a very large secondary groundwater plume. It's not known how significant the air emission pathway may be at AFFF sites. So, to think a little bit more about this in the context of site characterization, one important thing to note about AFFF impacted sites is the highly diverse mixtures of PFAS that are commonly found, and the differences in PFAS composition that result from different manufacturing methods over time. For example, PFAS are commonly produced by two manufacturing processes: electrochemical fluorination, ECF, and fluorotelomerization. ECF dominated earlier manufacture, but starting in the late 90s and early 2000s, multiple manufacturers began using fluorotelomerization. And with the phase out of PFOS manufacturing in the early 2000s, newer foam formulations have lower proportions of long-chain PFOS and higher proportions of PFOS with six or fewer carbons. Note that many manufacturers have begun shifting to fluorine-free foams. Now let's touch on forensic analysis of PFOS from AFFFs. This is based on fingerprinting the composition of unknown samples and comparing them with published fingerprints. However, caveats warranted. Precursor transformations can over time alter that original fingerprint, and there's batch variability and impurities associated with the manufacturing process that can also affect that original fingerprint. Now, because of the complexities and variability of AFFF sources and their associated environmental behaviors, we'll want to use multiple lines of evidence and analytical methods for fingerprinting. We should consider each site based on its unique features, chemical data, and historical information. So all this is just a teaser. We have an entire forensic section that will be covered by Skylar Sorsby later in the presentation. So just wanted to briefly mention it here in the context of site characterization. All right, let's shift now to industrial sites. Here we show a conceptualized CSM with pathways that you may want to consider when characterizing an industrial PFAS source. The actual PFAS released and the pathways they follow depends, of course, on the type of industry involved. Note that air emissions can be a significant pathway for industrial sources. Even though terminal perfluoroalkyl acids are not considered to be volatile, they can be released from stacks, either in vapor droplets or bound to particles. Volatile precursors, however, may be emitted and transformed to terminal perfluoroalkyl acids that are then deposited across potentially large areas. In addition, discharges to surface water from groundwater, stormwater runoff and effluent can spread contamination long distances from these source facilities. A special case of this is PFAS ending up in downstream drinking water intakes and associated supply lines, which can leak and infiltrate PFAS to groundwater, resulting in very large and distant, discontiguous PFAS footprints. This, in fact, occurred at a PFAS manufacturing facility in North Carolina and resulted in a four-county PFAS footprint far downstream of the site. A shift now to landfills and wastewater treatment plants. This CSM is a generalized assessment of key PFAS pathways at landfills and treatment plants. Landfills are aggregators of society's waste. Widespread use of PFAS in a host of commercial products means they're likely present in nearly all landfills. Their concentrations will depend on the particular waste streams that have entered that landfill. Higher concentrations would be expected in areas with industrial waste sources. Note that landfills and wastewater treatment plants commonly have a mutual dependence. What do I mean by that? It's most landfills truck or discharge their leachate to treatment plants via sewer systems. This, along with other sources, may contribute to the presence of PFAS in treatment plant effluent and biosolids. The biosolids often end up back in the landfills where the PFAS can once again enter landfill leachate, so it can form a sort of cycle. Note that the oxidation and digestion processes in treatment plants can enhance precursor transformation, resulting in some cases to greater measurable PFAS concentrations in the effluent than that of the influent. So, one other note, PFAS have been detected at elevated concentrations, say parts per billion, in runoff from composting sites in the United States, indicating that even residentially sourced paper products can create PFAS contaminated leachate. So, just to recap, we've covered source-specific considerations in a bit of detail, and we see that AFFF sources can be a diverse mix of PFAS that are highly dependent on the manufacturing methods of that AFFF. We also see that fate and transport can be affected by co-contaminants. For an industrial source, PFAS composition may be less diverse and will depend on the type of PFAS produced or used by that facility. Release mechanisms will be site-specific, and depending on facility operations, short or long-range air transport might be an important pathway to consider when performing a site characterization. And for a landfill source, PFAS composition and concentrations will vary depending on the wastes accepted. Leachate will tend to be predominated by PFAS with fewer than 8 carbons because they're less hydrophobic and therefore more likely to be in the aqueous phase. In particular, 5,3-fluorotelomer carboxylic acid, FTCA, is a common and often dominant PFAS found in landfills. PFAS may also be released to air from landfills, predominantly as a fluorotelomer alcohols, FTOHs, and perfluorobutanoate, PFBA. So for treatment plants and biosolids, the PFAS mix will depend on the PFAS entering the plant and the plant's treatment processes. Biological and chemical transformation of precursor compounds can create intermediate products and terminal perfluoroalkyl acids. These generalized CSMs for common source types provide a context for developing our site-specific conceptual site models. And these CSMs are a prelude to, and I'll say an integral part of, the site characterization process. So let's look briefly at our site-specific CSM and see how it fits into our site characterization. Shown here are some basic elements of the CSM. For starters, prior to or even part of an initial site visit, it's good to gather information on historical use of PFAS at the site. What type of PFAS site are we dealing with? What are current and historical site operations? Chemical inventories, waste handling processes. Are there permits in place? These help us understand what types of PFAS mixtures and potential commingled contaminants to look for and where to look. We also need to understand site features that impact fate and transport, including certain hydrogeologic details and surface features that may result in runoff to surface waters. What are the nature of surface water features and their capacity to convey PFAS downstream? How might rainfall patterns affect runoff and surface water transport? Is groundwater impacted and to what extent? How susceptible are the nearest supply wells based on local geology, proximity, and pumping characteristics? If atmospheric releases have occurred, do we understand wind and deposition patterns? In short, have we identified all susceptible receptors? One reminder, it's critical during the site characterization of PFAS that the nearest groundwater and surface water drinking water supplies be identified. So all of this will drive how and where to sample to evaluate the nature and extent of PFAS impacts to soil, groundwater, surface water, sediment, and air. Note also that it's important that we identify at the outset any permit limits or federal or state regulations or concentration thresholds that apply to the site. And finally, we want to update and improve our CSM as new information becomes available. We will lean on it to understand additional data needs throughout site characterization, risk assessment, and remediation planning. So let's now take a look at some key data needed to understand transport pathways, focusing here on releases to groundwater and factors that may affect migration or retention. Any discussion of groundwater transport should start with the vadose zone and factors that may inhibit or enhance movement of PFAS through this zone. We'll cover some of these factors in the next slide, and of course, we've heard quite a bit about this in the sessions from the prior speakers. So, focusing on groundwater, we will want to understand how and where PFAS will move through advection, dispersion, and potential retention, including matrix diffusion. At the most basic level, we will need to understand groundwater flow directions and gradients based on water level measurements. And we'll want to assess potential subsurface heterogeneities. Do we have soil layering with clays, or perhaps fractured bedrock or karst? How permeable are these materials? Here we would rely on, for example, slug or aquifer testing. Note that perfluoroalkyl acids tend to move readily once they enter groundwater, but certain factors can affect this, as we heard earlier, including the PFAS compound, soil type, pH, total dissolved solids, co-contaminants, and others. Let's now look at what we may want to analyze to understand the movement of PFAS through the vadose zone. Of course, site-specific and climate-related factors like precipitation, depth to water, infiltration rates will affect the rate the system flushes PFAS, or most any contaminant for that matter. Also, soil properties like surface charge, pH, and carbon content generally will affect the transport of most contaminants through the vadose zone. That said, there are a number of unique attributes specific to PFAS that affect its movement through the vadose zone. Chief among them, the propensity for PFAS compounds to accumulate at the air-water interface. Information collected as part of the site characterization should account for these. For example, we may want to analyze soil porosity, organic carbon content, bulk density, ionic composition, anion and cation exchange capacity, grain size, mineralogy, water content, and we would want information on subsurface geochemistry, including ionic strength and composition, dissolved oxygen, oxidation reduction conditions, and pH. Taken together, this information helps us evaluate how PFAS would be expected to migrate through the vadose zone. Note that we may see pulses of PFAS concentrations entering groundwater with time, based on flushing events and PFAS properties like chain links. So, another thing we want to be aware of during site characterization is that PFAS sampling is different from other sampling events due to an increased potential for inadvertent sample contamination. So, what I mean by contamination here is the unintentional introduction of PFAS into your sample container during sample collection, shipping, or storage. This can occur due to three main reasons. First, some sampling equipment and materials may contain PFAS. Shown here are a few. Second, our samples are analyzed at extremely low levels, parts per trillion for aqueous, parts per billion for soils. And third, PFAS can exist at a sampling location at concentrations that are orders of magnitude higher than our screening or regulatory threshold. So there is an increased risk that routine decontamination processes are inadequate and result in cross-contaminated samples. So many of the state-specific guidance documents detail specific materials and products to avoid during sampling. But the bottom line is be meticulous with sampling equipment, materials, and procedures, and collect plenty of equipment rinsate and related QC samples to avoid false positive results. So, when sampling for PFAS in surface water, another important consideration is foam containing PFAS. This foam results from dissolved phase PFAS compounds in surface waters that have been agitated by wind or wave action and aggregated into a mass above the surface water. Note that this is not the same as AFFF foams used for firefighting that can be transported to surface waters. So concentrations of PFAS-containing foam can be tens of thousands of times higher than concentrations in water below it. In fact, one Minnesota study found that PFAS in foam enriched by over 100,000 times that of surface water in which it floated, and was enriched in long-chain PFAS over that of short chains. Foam on surface water can be found in all seasons and can be white, brown, or orange. Note that these foams are easily windblown, resulting in further PFAS transport across the water body. Shown here are the four layers to consider when collecting samples. On top is the highly enriched foam. Below this is the surface microlayer, which includes the air-water interface and likely contains the highest PFAS concentrations in the water column itself. Below this is the Neuston layer, which contains minute aquatic organisms. And this layer is important because the aquatic community is potentially in contact with the highest concentration of PFAS that occurs in that surface microlayer. And then underlying this is the water column with sediment on the bottom. So remember that even if PFAS is not detected in surface water, it may be detected in the foam located immediately above it. So we also wanted to touch briefly on the importance in understanding the variety of analytical methods available for PFAS detection. These methods can differ in how the samples are prepared, overall quantitation schemes using internal or external standards, and even some incorporating isotope dilution. As we see in the table here, the number of PFAS analyzed can vary in these methods from 2 analytes up to 40 analytes, using, for example, EPA method 1633. In all cases, the quantitation limits will be dependent upon the specific PFAS evaluated, the matrix that's analyzed, and the methods utilized. For our purposes here in site characterization, we must consider all these di analytical differences when choosing the most appropriate method for a given site to ensure that project objectives are met. I mentioned earlier that ITRC has a training on sampling analysis that looks at this topic in detail, and see the chat box for the link to that. And my last slide before I turn it back over to Robert describes a useful and somewhat semi-qualitative analysis called the TOP assay. Shown here, which stands for total oxidizable precursors. This is an analysis that helps us evaluate the amount of precursors that may be contributing or contribute in the future to perfluoroalkyl acid concentrations we are measuring at a site. This lab method converts precursor compounds to terminal perfluoroalkyl acids through oxidative digestion. the increase in perfluoroalkyl acids measured after the TOP assay relative to before is an estimate of the total oxidizable precursors present in a sample. Note that TOP digestion is relatively harsh and thus may overestimate the amount of precursor oxidation that would be expected under field conditions. Still, it can be a useful tool in assessing potential transformations that are or may occur at a site. Note also that the perfluoroalkyl acids generated have perfluoroalkyl chain lengths equal to or shorter than those present in the precursors. So again, from a site characterization perspective, TOP assay can provide an additional line of evidence for source differentiation. Now, I'll say caution should be used in its application because of the likelihood of cationic and zwitterionic precursors to sorbent soils. In other words, comparison of source samples to downgradient samples may be complicated by environmental fractionation, which we heard about earlier. The ITRC sampling and analysis training goes into this topic as well. So, with that, I will turn it back over to Robert. Thank you.
Okay. So we've talked about fate and transport. We've talked about how that informs how you're going to take your approach to site characterization. We've talked about what data we want to gather and how to gather it. So now let's talk about what we do with that data. With those data. These PFAS data sets can be large and complex. So we need to kind of think of ways to help us interpret and visualize the data. And so that's what we're going to cover here is ways that data visualization can help us to understand what's going on at our site a little bit better. Or just help us translate that large data sets into something that we can really sink our teeth into. So, for example, we have up on this slide bar charts, which can be a great way to show actual concentrations while also comparing the presence of PFAS species within samples. So you can see these stacked bar charts from different samples showing the different PFAS concentrations and different composition of PFAS, with some species showing up in some samples and not others. Pie charts and these radar plots or spider charts or radial diagrams, they're sometimes called. These are great at showing proportions of a total, right? So the In a pie chart, of course, we have wedges of different colors representing different PFAS species or categories of PFAS. You can see that in red, for example, on that first one, we have the carboxylates, PFCAs, with PFSAs in yellow and so forth. So again, these are for showing proportions of the total with wedges of varying sizes. Radar plots can either show actual values, actual concentrations plotted on multiple axes, or possibly more commonly, they can show proportions or ratios of specific compounds or groups relative to the total measured. The latter is accomplished by dividing the concentration of an individual compound by the total concentration of all measured PFAS. It's a method of normalizing data. So it's important to remember that analytical precision gets less certain with very low levels of PFAS or really any contaminant. So when those levels are very low, it could affect those ratios and give you less certainty that that's a true ratio because of analytical imprecision. So just important to remember that when we're using data with low levels. Viewing data in these ways can have many purposes, from the mundane to the cutting edge. And the next few slides will include some case studies that use some of these tools to evaluate environmental fractionation and the effects of in situ petroleum remediation on PFAS composition in PFAS plumes. There is a little overlap with these data visualization techniques and some forensics techniques that we can apply. So Skylar will talk more about that in the upcoming forensics section. So, sticking with radial diagrams for a moment, or those spider plots, we'll return to this generalized hypothetical scenario for an AFFF site that we brought up earlier in the fate and transport section. As mentioned, then we can expect our PFAS composition or proportions of various PFAS species to change over the length of a plume. And these radial diagrams are one way to visualize the compositional changes. Now, in this example, we've selected a subset of PFAS, just four in this radial diagram, and that's primarily for simplicity. And we can, that's often how it's done. We might have a data set with, dozens of PFAS in it, depending on what analytical method we used and, what we actually have at our site, of course. But we can simplify the data by just choosing the most common constituents. And that can really tell us a lot and make our data visualization just kind of easier to absorb. So again, four compounds being plotted on these radial diagrams. We have A2 fluorotelomer sulfonate, PFNA on the top, PFOS on the right, and PFHXA on the bottom. And so we can see, if you look at the as we look along the axis of the plume, we can see that you can use this tool to visualize the changes in ratios of these various constituents. So you can see in the beginning, we have a lot of A2 fluorotelomer sulfonate. For example, as we move down gradient, that precursor gets broken down and we see less of it relative to total PFAS. And instead, we see increasing proportions of those carboxylates and sulfonates. And of course, we also see more of an increase in the carboxylates because sulfonates tend to be retained more than carboxylates. If we plotted additional short chain, we would see an increase in those two. Now, again, this is made up data, so don't do too much with it. But this is just a hypothetical example of what we might see if we use these plots to visualize data at a site like this. And in fact, we have real life examples of having used that data at sites like this. So this first case study is from Sweden, where data visualization using radial diagrams was useful to help them understand what was going on at their site. In this case, they are plotting concentrations of three groups of PFAS and one specific compound of interest. It's plotted on four axes again, using a logarithmic scale. So make sure you make note of that logarithmic scale, of course. The groups are the sum of the measured PFCAs, the sum of the measured PFSAs, and then other precursors. So precursors besides 6,2 fluorotelomer sulfonate, which is their single compound of interest. And that was just differentiated in this case because of site-specific considerations that we don't need to get into. But the patterns in the shape that result from plotting these on this axis like this pertain to the precursor and PFAA relationships. And again, these are connected just because it's a visual tool. There's no, the lines drawn between the different axes are just to help us visualize. There's no other meaning there. So if you look at what actually happened at the site, I know it might be a lot to look at on the screen, but there are some patterns that are evident from the data. So first, we can see that the presence of PFSAs, PFCAs, and fluorotelomer sulfonates indicates that the foams used here were produced by telomerization, right? It's because we see those fluorotelomer sulfonates, and just the composition in general of those foams. So additionally, a decrease in concentration of PFAAs can be seen along the main flow channel around the source area is around G8 and G9. It's circled in black here. And in the inset, that purple box, we can see that precursor concentrations are higher at the fire training areas and decrease down gradient. Now that might be a result of sorption and less transport of those precursors, or it might be a result of biotransformation or abiotic transformation, or a combination of those things. And this next case study, we have four specific PFAS that are plotted, kind of like my hypothetical example. So the use of the dark blue outline represents the source area samples. So that's what we that dark blue outline is what we see in the source area. So they're actually preserving that on every location that they've plotted on this map to for an easy visual comparison, whereas the shaded lighter blue color represents the concentrations at the actual sample. So one pattern that emerges from this data is that we see that the precursor compound FHXSA is reduced in concentrations near the dissolved oxygen infusion wells that were used here. So again, just looking at the legend there, those are the little triangles around there. So you can see how that introduction of DO infusion wells reduced the precursor ratios and concentrations, probably by increasing transformation rates. So that's wraps up our section on site characterization and data visualization. And we're going to take a quick break before getting into forensics. Give us a chance to kind of rest our brains before getting into the real dense stuff.
All right, thank you, Robert. So, as Robert said, we've now reached our Q&A break, our first Q&A break of the training. We will have one more at the end if we have time. So, I do have a few questions for our trainers. We don't have too much time. So, first question, can you explain why PFSAs sorb more strongly than PFCAs to organic carbon?
Sure. This is sorry, this is Dina. I can take that question. So the sulfonate head group is more hydrophobic, and so it has stronger electrostatic interactions with the organic carbon than the carboxylate group. So this generally will just give you a higher KD or KOC. And then, of course, like we discussed earlier, this effect would be amplified for those longer chain ones.
Great. Thank you, Dina. Any of the other trainers have any other comments for that question? If not, I can move on to another one. All right. For PFAS sources to air from stack emissions, what are the transport pathways that we should be looking at? Any of the trainers have any thoughts for that one?
Sure, I could take a stab at it. When we're talking about stack emissions, we're looking at PFAS that that have basically been forced into air, even if they're not ordinarily particularly volatile. And so short range transport on particulates or short range transport in general, and processes like wet and dry deposition are some of the processes that you'd want to look at in terms of air transport. You're going to want to understand the wind patterns, of course, in the area, if there's any shifts in that on a daily or seasonal basis, to make sure that you're targeting those right the correct areas for your samples.
All right, thank you, Robert. And if none of the other trainers have any comments, I will go ahead and move forward with the training, just so we can keep on track with the time, but we will hopefully have a little more time at the end to ask some more questions. So thank you all for continuing to interact with that Q&A box. All right, and I'm now going to turn this over to Skylar to introduce forensics for us.
All right, so we've talked about characterization, we've talked about fate and transport. Now we'll talk about forensics, which is kind of coming at things from a little bit of a different but very complementary perspective. So one of the goals for this part of the module is to kind of walk out of it understanding more about source ID, what goes into that or what could go into that, and a few techniques for distinguishing sources from each other. And also from other processes. So what is environmental forensics? As a field, it's a fairly mature approach to assessing environmental chemistry data. With regards to PFAS, it's still relatively in its nascent stages. It's still, we're still bringing the practices over from other constituents. Other areas of the field and applying them to PFAS. So this discussion is going to draw upon some fairly established methods and show how they relate to PFAS. But definitely consider these methods carefully and use practitioners who know how to apply these methods and definitely keep the nuances that we've talked about regarding fate and transport in mind. So kind of the goals of forensics is to take your data and maybe collect ancillary data sets. You want to be able to identify what the sources are on your site, if there are any. You want to be able to distinguish between multiple sources, if there are any, on-site versus off-site sources. And often this kind of culminates in unraveling commingled plumes if you're looking in groundwater and you've got multiple sources. Now, in order to be able to comment on sources and identify and isolate what they are and where they are, you also have to address natural attenuation processes, fate and transport processes, etc. And ultimately, this does play back into the CSM, where you have to have a good idea of what's going on at the site. So we'll get into how this applies to PFAS next. As I said, we're still bringing these kind of time-honored methods over into PFAS. So you'll look in the literature and find a lot of recent literature. We're going to talk about a few kind of the key methods that have definitely distinguished themselves. So specifically to PFAS, we want to know where the sources are. This could relate to firefighting training areas. This could relate to multiple different formulations of AFFF used in firefighting. This could relate to leachate at landfills. We want to know what the sources are. We want to identify them and identify where they are. We want to be able to unravel if there are overlapping PFAS sources. And we also want to understand a little bit about environmental fractionation. Is this signature I'm seeing in this particular sample due to a source? Is it due to an environmental process that's just modifying the flavor of my source? That's definitely very important to have an understanding of. And then again, also kind of tracking that evolution of these signatures, of these fingerprints, so to speak, along flow paths of your site to be able to tell if it's a source or if it's a transport mechanism. So understanding the history of your site's really important, and being able to bring the results of the analyses or we've already talked about and the ones that we're yet to talk about back to the historical site records and the CSM and reconcile them all. So idea between identifying the source and differentiating that source from other things. Identifying the source is kind of a main objective here. We want to know where it is. To get to that point, we may have to untangle the data from multiple sources. Again, talking about commingling or overlapping sources. Let's say you're sampling along a plume and you are starting to get some results that just look different. And you want to be able to say, is this a source? Is this a transport pattern? Or even still, is this potentially some sort of non-point contribution that's getting into the site? So starting to get into some of these methods, there are kind of two limbs to a forensic analysis, and one is transforming the data. How you transform the data definitely affects the results you'll get from these methods. And then the other is kind of taking all of the pieces as a whole. So looking at, traditionally in the environmental industry, we'll look at one thing at a time. We'll make a map of PFOS. We'll make a trend graph of PFOS. And then we'll rinse and repeat for many other things. So we could do this, 40 times, 80 times. And we usually take things one at a time. And what these methods are going to do is kind of successively group the full data set together. So these are kind of whole data set methods as we get into them. So we'll start kind of more simply, looking at the relative amounts of things with ratios, getting farther into data visualization, which can handle a little bit more complexity and a few more samples, and then getting into a few specialized analytical techniques, and then kind of finally landing at these kind of whole data set techniques like PCA or cluster analysis. So kind of off the bat, what is a diagnostic ratio? You can make ratios out of a lot of different things in your data set here. And really what it is kind of two main ways of going about it. You either compare the relative composition of your samples. So here, if you see sample A and sample B, these are two hypothetical samples that we're trying to distinguish and say, are they the same or are they different? You can see we have the carboxylates here, we have the sulfonates here, and fluorotelomer sulfonates. So we're looking at relative abundance for the first three rows. And the idea being you group those constituents together and you take the sum totals and divide by the total of the concentration of the entire sample. And what you get is something between 0 and 1. So focusing on the first three rows here, sample A is enriched in PFSAs and sample B is enriched with PFCAs. And here, that's very clearly different. Those are two very clearly different samples because those compositional ratios are so different. Now, a different way of going about it is to compare two constituents or groups of constituents together. So instead of a total percentage, you could look at let's say divide the PFCAs by the PFSAs, and instead, you get similar information out of it. Looking at sample A, it's a very small number, but instead, this type of approach isn't limited to a max value of 1, so you get a much larger number, 22 for sample B. And then, if you wanted to kind of get even more granular and step down to two compounds specifically, looking at PFOA and PFOS, again, very small number versus very large number. Now, these are all ratios. These are all ways of going about it. They take two things and compare them so that you can then compare that number, that ratio between other samples, and you can bake your whole data set into it. tallying the different types of compounds together before you do the ratio, but ultimately you're comparing two things together, and you're comparing two samples together. So if you want to scale beyond ratios, you start getting into data visualization. And these are a few we've already talked about, but these are also very common environmental forensics. You're looking for your kind of fingerprinting profile. And here, this is a bar chart, an unstacked bar chart. And it's normalized so that the y-axis is a percentage rather than a total concentration. And that lets us kind of stack them together. So you can see in sample one, we're dominated by PFOA, PFHPA, whereas in sample two, we're dominated by PFPEA and PFHXA. So, and not just those, but you can see the overall mood is different between the two samples. Just the profile. If you're looking at the full profile, they're a little bit different. So this is again normalized to 100%. You know, oftentimes you'll probably see something similar to this in the form of a pie chart, and a pie chart that you can show on a map. So the idea being, you can quickly compare not just two things, but here you're comparing a number of different constituents together, but you're still kind of only showing two samples easily, at least on the same page. So if you want to scale beyond that a little bit more, this is a stacked bar chart. Now, the right panel here, the right-hand panel, is a little different. There's a couple of nuances to it. The upper one, yeah, so these would appear to be stacked by concentration. You can see they have varying heights to them. So that's something you can do. We've got the numbers on the top, in fact, indicating the raw concentration. So that's a way that you can tell different samples apart. You've got these, so in the stack chart specifically, the different colors now are what the individual bars were on the previous slide. So a blue bar is different from a blue, light blue, red bar. Those are, and again, those colors relate to different constituents. So again, compositionally, you're looking across and you're looking for basically different patterns in color. And here, instead of just two samples, you've got six different samples. And you can say, well, these ratios look similar, but one sample is much higher in concentration than another. And that's where you start to get into what's source-like versus not source-like. So here you've scaled, you've kept the number of constituents, and you're now increasing the number of samples. But even then, you start to hit a bit of a threshold of how much can actually be practical to look at. Scaling up, you know, this is honestly about the same level of scale. Looking at a radial diagram, we've seen these before. This is where I think it's important to note that your data transformations do have an effect on what the visual looks like. So radar chart, you read instead of up from the bottom like you would on a bar chart, you're reading out from the center. So you can see if you trace out from the center for these different constituents, sample A is dominated by PFOS and a little bit less by PFHXS. Sample B is dominated by PFNA primarily. So in this case, the data are normalized to tally to a total, you know, to a percentage again, in this case, a fraction. So the highest thing is like 60%, and that would be PFOS. Now, there's another common transformation folks are probably familiar with, which is a logarithmic transformation. In that case, going out from the center isn't a percentage, it's a concentration. So patterns farther from the center would be higher concentration samples. Patterns closer to the center would be lower concentration samples. So you really do have to track your data transformations and remember the effect that they could have on these graphs. But even so, like you've got some patterns. This is a fairly compelling difference. But let's say you start getting more and more samples, it does start to become cluttered. And if you have more constituents, like let's say a larger analytical suite, it just becomes kind of incomprehensible at some point. So what do you do when you need to scale up from this? This is where we would start talking about multivariate approaches. Multivariate's a large word. It can be intimidating, but really at the end of the day, the kind of the key players in these analyses are your data transformations and an understanding of what these methods do. So again, definitely keeping in mind that when you do PCA or factor analysis or cluster analysis, have an analyst to do it who's familiar with the analysis, or be prepared to really do some homework to make sure you're understanding what you're doing. So for PCA and factor analysis, these are also called dimensionality reduction methods. So imagine, you make 100 graphs for 100 different constituents, and instead you could make one graph that shows them all. That's kind of the goal, or you could have a couple of graphs that show them all. That's the goal of a dimensionality reduction method, is it collapses the information into a much smaller data set or a much smaller number of things to consider. It's kind of it extracts kind of a latent trend from the data. Now, cluster analysis extracts latent groups from the data. It focuses on similarity and dissimilarity. So for the following examples, we'll be relying on this table at the right. So imagine in your table, every row is a different sample and every column is a different analyte. I think for each example we have about 8 data points. So again, principal components, you can think about this as if you had your multivariate data cloud. Let's say there are how many constituents? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. We can't see in 5D, but these methods can. So if you have a data cloud in 5D, what principal components is trying to do is it's going to spear the data along the direction of the greatest spread. This may or may not align with a particular source. It's just the greatest spread in the data cloud. And then what it does successively is it spears the data through the next direction of greatest spread, but it locks it in at basically right angles at orthogonality. So what you get essentially is this thing on the right. This is a representation of the data using the outputs of PCA. You can see our data cloud is 8 data points. The black axes, PC1 and 2, are basically those spears that I mentioned that went through the data set in the directions of greatest spread, or that's what the analysis should do. And then it represents it in 2D, or if you want to, in 3D, depending on how many PCs you keep. Now, what this does is it collapses the samples. So every row, instead of having 5 things to go with it, there's just one data point per sample now. So those are the 8 data points shown on the graph. And the columns are shown as arrows. That's the 5 red arrows here. So you can quickly see the trends in your data. You can see which samples are aligning with which constituents. You've got samples 1, 2, and 3 going with PFOA and PFBA. PFOS is loading for samples 4 and 6. And then PFBS and PFNA are loading for samples 5, 7, and 8. And that can quickly tell you some fairly salient patterns in your data. Keep in mind too, along these axes, we have a percent of variance explained. PCA inherently does not capture 100% of the information in two degrees here, unless you're only looking at two constituents, which really at that point just make a scatter plot. Just definitely you have to take the plot that you get with a grain of salt, but definitely if you do PCA, make a biplot. That's like the standard output, and it can help you unpack some of these major trends in your data. Clustering is a bit of a different animal. Instead of maximizing the variance, looking for the directions of biggest spread, it looks at sample similarity. So once it looks for things that are close together in 5D, or let's say if you have a large assay, maybe 30D, 40D, 60D, all these dimensions. Again, it does something that we can't intuitively do, but the machine can. It'll compare the concentrations of each sample and just check which ones are close and which ones are far away. That's kind of the nuts and bolts of it. Now here, this thing is called a dendrogram. This is a specific form of clustering called hierarchical clustering, where at the base of this tree, so to speak, these are the nodes, and those represent individual samples. And as you kind of look at that level of granularity at the bottom. Everything's different. But as you kind of zoom out, certain things are more similar to each other than others. And that's what forms the branches that form cluster 3, 2, and 1. At some point, everything is similar, you know, if you look at it with a broad enough brush. But it's up to the analyst to determine at what level is it relevant? At what level is the cluster structure relevant? So here, three are fairly distinct. Now, it's important to keep in mind too that just because a clustering output gives you a number, it doesn't necessarily mean that those are really well-defined clusters. It just means that those samples are more similar to each other than other things. So it's important to, again, check your work, do your homework, make sure you have good diagnostics in place to kind of vet your answers. And then when you tie that to the PFAS data, to the actual meaning, it's important to understand that these aren't necessarily different sources. You could have a lower concentration group that's just like diluted samples. You could have a non-point source. You could have data, you could have transformations, et cetera. These aren't, each cluster isn't necessarily a source. So you have to then again interpret carefully. Factor analysis, also known as receptor modeling in the literature, is similar to principal components analysis, but unlike principal components analysis, it doesn't throw orthogonal spears through your data to preserve that structure. It goes through the data at angles. This is more of an exemplar identification effort where you're finding the unique signatures in the data. So to do this, you have to estimate how many you think there are, and then what the method will do is it will extract the profiles of those end members, so to speak, and also the contributions of each end member to each sample. Again, you know, it's up to the analyst to determine how many, and the contributions to those samples aren't necessarily source contributions. It could be an ambient signature, it could be a fate and transport process or a precursor transformation. So again, interpreting carefully. So again, each of these methods are limited. That's not to say don't use them, but be careful when you use them and use them well. Factor analysis and clustering require the user to specify a guess of how many. There's diagnostic ways to do this, but beyond the scope of this presentation. The analyst also has to iterate a few times and just check to make sure that's a good answer. And then at the end of the day, this is not a method, these aren't methods that will tell you the answer per se. They will give you a result that you must interpret in light of the CSM and the chemistry. So there are site sort, you know, there's conditions that will affect these signatures. You know, again, they'll so we're identifying signatures here, and then the trick is identifying true sources out of those signatures versus things that are not sources per se. There could be diffuse or ambient signatures in samples. There could be fractionation due to transport. You could have precursor transformations or other reactions going on, and you could be fingerprinting those things rather than a true source. And again, you know, one of the baselines of forensics is use it as a line of evidence, but use other things to go with it. Other lab analyses like branched or linear isomers. Again, putting it on a map, put it on a map and see where these things are, see how things change over time, and compare it to your site history records. Those are very strong ways to leverage the CSM to kind of check your work and interpret the data. So looking at physical and chemical processes, you know, again, a source or a sample in a source area may still may reflect the same thing as a downgradient sample. It just may have fractionated along the way. There's things that you also measure typically, like the pH, the redox, soil parameters that you can use to help you understand not only the CSM, but also your PFAS data. And then there's things about the compounds themselves, like the chain length, the functional groups, the structure that can give you clues to help unpack these analyses as well. We've got a few literature references here for later review if you want to see some of these methods used in action. And there's definitely a number of other references as well in the ITRC guidance document. So with that, I will pass it back over for review and wrap up.
All right, thank you, Skylar. Quite a lot of information there. So yeah, just to review, we covered in this module site characterization, patent transport, and source identification and forensics. We hope that we've given you a better idea of patent transport processes that are unique to PFAS, how their physical and chemical properties play a role in that. And how to use that information to help plan your site characterization effort and really target the appropriate sample locations and types of samples as well. And then we've given you an overview of how to interpret some of those data for different purposes, including potentially looking at forensics and distinguishing between different sources. So again, this is one resource of many that ITRC PFAS team has developed. We build these trainings off of our online guidance document, which you can find at the link on this slide. You can also find introductory training for folks who would like to go back and get some of the basics. There's an archived introductory training, and we give that live occasionally as well. And other video resources as well, and all those other resources that are available. So if you need a little bit more to help out help your understanding after getting this training, check out all those resources. We're really proud of them. And just as a reminder, this is one of five modules in this Beyond the Basics training. So feel free to jump in and to the ITRC website and find those other archived trainings. Also, if you'd like to give us any feedback, there's a link there to a feedback form and certificate for the training. So please feel free to check that out. With that, I'll hand it back to Taylor.
All right, thank you, Robert, and thank you, Skylar. We've now reached the end of the training and the last Q&A portion. I do realize that we are a bit over time, so I'm just going to ask Skylar one question before I wrap it up today. For factor analysis, can you give an example of what the factors represent?
Yeah, so factor analysis, kind of an exemplar analysis, the most unique signatures in your data, and again, these could be anything from sources to non-point. Or ambient contributions or fate and transport. So I wouldn't be surprised if you have a source or two that could be represented by factors, but then you've got to unpack too, which of these profiles could be due to fate and transport, where are they located, what's around them, what other context can you add, and then the ever-present question of like, what is a non-point source and where, how do I tease that out of the results as well? But yeah, you could be all of those things. And especially within a single site, you could have multiple sources as well.
All right. Thank you, Skylar. And thank you to all the trainers for being here today. And thank you all for attending the training. We would like to hear back from you. So please be sure to fill out the online feedback form that is on this last slide and posted in the chat. Filling out the feedback form and certifying that you participated will allow you to receive a certificate of completion by email. If you need further clarification on the answers or would like to ask more questions, feel free to email us at itrc@itrcweb.org, and we will follow up with our trainers to get your questions answered. Thank you all.